Good morning. So this morning is going to require just a little bit of work on your part. The first few minutes, the first 10 or 15 minutes, because we're going through some pretty intense ideas. And so, you know, like they said on Little House on the Prairie, put your thinking caps on now, kids. Because I was a little concerned about how it was going to start out, but it's important enough, I think, from my perspective at least, and hopefully you'll see the importance of it as well. So where do we begin? We're starting in Exodus. So we have officially left Genesis. It only took so many months, but we're out of Genesis. We're into Exodus now. And what's interesting about Exodus is that it is the central story of the Jewish faith, more so than Genesis, more so than any other story. In the Old Testament is the story of the Exodus, the creation story in Genesis, even the story of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Joseph. Even those are important, but they're not central to the identity of the Jewish faith. And it's this experience of moving from slavery to freedom that stands as the essence of the definition of what it means. To be a Jew, what it means to be a follower of Yahweh. And so what that means then is that the central identity for the Jewish person, and by extension, though to a lesser degree for us as the new Israel, is this sort of central identity of the wilderness. You know, it's kind of interesting if you think about it, that if this is the central story that defines the essence of what it means to be a chosen people, followers of Yahweh, then that means that your central identity is wrapped up in wilderness, in being in the wilderness, in this passage from slavery to freedom. It's very much also, and this is where the paradox comes, and this is the part that is going to require some just clever thinking on your part. But the Jewish faith is very much wrapped up in place. It's wrapped up in a place, right? But even more than that, it's in this movement in that place from slavery to freedom. So it's two things that seem to be at odds with each other. It's an identity of place and movement. Place and motion. And this is where we get this kind of weird Aristotelian vibe going on. And Aristotle's gloss on Plato, where the whole Platonic structure of reality was things very much, there was a static aspect to Plato and Platonism. And Aristotle wasn't convinced, though he was the student of Plato, wasn't convinced that Plato had figured out yet what reality meant in motion, because things in motion needed to be described. Things in motion needed to be understood. And so Aristotle takes what Plato had built as a foundation, and he ups the ante, and essentially, though I'm putting a lot of this into my own words, it's essence found in motion. That's what defines something. So Aristotle used two words interchangeably, energia and entelechia. So it's obviously pretty obvious, energy and entelechy. Entelechy is not a word that too many of us are familiar with, but entelechy shows sort of this built-in purpose, trajectory. And Aristotle used those two words interchangeably to describe motion, which is what makes a living thing a living thing. Energy and entelechy, or purpose, or trajectory, or movement. The latter, this entelechy, also another word that we use for it is potential. So every living thing has sort of this built-in potential. And I don't mean potential in the sense that we use it commonly today as, boy, that person has a lot of potential. If you are a living thing, you have potential. And all that means is that you are there, and this is where Aristotle took Plato's foundation and just worked on it, but there's an ideal you are reaching for. The New Testament is all about this. I mean, Paul being the sort of the good kind of semi-Platonist that he was like, you know, it's all about growing into the measure and the full stature of Christ. That's what it means to be fully human. So that's all of our potential, is to become more Christ-like. So every human has potential in that we're becoming more Christ-like. So what you have then in Aristotle is potential and then that potential actualized. So those are the two words. Don't be frightened by them, right? Potentiality and actuality. And they coexist for Aristotle. And it's the energy of potentiality and the actualizing of that potential that makes us human, that makes us who we are. It means that's what it means to be alive. In a sense, that interesting dynamic is the vital principle of the soul from Aristotle's perspective. And it's even touched on in the Hebraic language in this Semitic idea that when God breathes into Adam, he's in effect actualizing the potential. He's giving Adam life. That spark, that's the life that we have, right? Which is different from the Christian conception of the spirit. Spirit and soul are not the same thing for the Christian. Soul, even modern psychologists and philosophers will refer to the soul without being believers necessarily, because that's a more mystical or transcendent word for mind or anima, right? What makes a person or a thing animated, anima. So it's this soul. So anyway, from Aristotle's perspective, this kind of bringing together of actuality and potentiality was the vital principle of the soul, that things are what they are in movement. They're not in some kind of static existence. So for Aristotle, motion then connotes change, and he defines motion as the actuality of potentiality. That's what motion is. It's this thing is born with this potential, and then when it starts to move in that direction, aha, there you have motion, and there you have what it means to be alive. So for a thing to be a thing in the world is to be a thing at work, is to be a thing that is changing, but not just changing indiscriminately, not just changing by accident, but changing with a purpose. All right, so in short, to actualize your potential is what it means to be alive. Right? Okay, great. So then St. Thomas Aquinas comes along, and he adds to this, to the Aristotelian idea, by suggesting that for something to be alive is for that thing to be what it is and also what it is becoming, but it's not yet there. And he took it and he baptized Aristotle's idea, and he said, well, that's Christianity in a nutshell. Is that we are all born into being, but we are all called to become something. And so that called into being and that reaching that thing simultaneously is what it means to be a follower of Christ, what it means to be created in the image of God. And maybe I'll put, this is the last way I'll put it, to be in motion is to be in the present and the future at the same time. Now, I know that starts to sound kind of weird. The future, which is potentiality, is what gives the present actuality its shape. Have you thought about that? That you and me and everyone in this room, we are so accustomed to defining ourselves by who we are right now, and none of us has access to the future. And yet what Aquinas is saying, taking the Aristotelian idea that was so rich and so powerful and so potent, and he takes it and he realizes, he just sort of lays it on the blueprint of the Christian faith and says, oh my goodness, look at that. This is exactly what the Bible has been saying all along, is that God has this thing called providence. He has a call for us. He has a purpose for us. He has a direction for us, so that we are shaped, here's the fun part, we are shaped as much by our future that we are not aware of as we are by our past that we've already lived through. We're all, to a greater or lesser degree, depending on how much therapy you've had or you need, you are shaped consciously by your past, and so you kind of know like where you're being pushed and sort of what direction and what your biases are, your family history, your own DNA, but what none of us really know is how is the future shaping us? Because we're being shaped by the future too. So that potentiality actually gives our present some shape, some form. And we, all we really can do, with the help of a lot of prayer and a good Christian community and good fellowship and koinonia and preaching and all the rest, right, is that we can start to get a glimpse of where we're headed. We can kind of, we all know, at least in theory, that we are to become more Christ-like. We get that. But what's really fascinating, isn't it, is that our future is shaping us. And for God, our future is every bit as much of a reality as our present. I mean, that's just the kind of thing that just keeps you up at night with a smile on your face. Like, wow, that's just so kind of cool, right? That God, you know, the old, I know not what the future holds, but I know who holds the future. And it's sort of like, you know, God understands. Anyway, I just find that really lovely. But that's, so when you think about it, what does this have to do at all with Exodus? Well, think about the name, Exodus. Exodus makes sense because it's movement. Genesis makes sense because it's movement. The Genesis is the beginning of something, and there's that ever-present tense, right? Genesis. It's the genesis of something that God is, and what's lovely about Hebrew or Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, really, the Hebrew reads, while God was creating. Not in the beginning God created. That's just, that's an Anglicizing, whatever. It's turning it in English. It's while God was creating. Well, now we have Exodus, so it's almost the same idea. While God was freeing. Present tense. It's happening. It's not something that happened, but it continues. It's like the Greek aorist tense of the verb. The aorist tense is something that happened in the past and continues in the future. It continues, and we don't have that tense in English. A-O-R-I-S-T, the aorist tense in Greek. Happened and it continues to affect us. It's a lovely tense, and maybe that's the problem with a lot of our theology is we need to reintroduce the aorist tense into English. So how does this then relate to Exodus and the Jews? Well, Exodus is this movement. And so if I'm suggesting that, well, I'm not suggesting it, biblical scholars have suggested it, that the central story of the Jewish faith and the Judeo-Christian tradition is the Exodus. And incidentally, Jesus is the New Testament version of Moses. He's delivering his people from slavery into freedom, right? Which is why when Nicodemus asks Jesus, what does it mean to be, what does this all mean, this being born again? And not surprisingly, Jesus brings up Moses and says, well, remember in the wilderness when Moses, you know, had them put those snakes up on that same thing. He's equating himself. He's the new Moses. He's the new Adam, too. So this Jewish identity, then, is fluid. It's one of motion and movement. It's one of actuality and potentiality all at the same time. And Scott, who is constantly giving me things to read, and they're almost always very good, he gave me this lovely piece from a book called Nothing Sacred. What's the name of the author again?
I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the author.
Okay, I'm glad. So neither can I. I should have known it. But in any case, called Nothing Sacred, and he writes this about this Jewish identity. He said, "What is a Jew, or more precisely, an Israelite?" Jew is actually a misnomer, a word used to identify the people of Judea, the sole surviving kingdom of Israel after the Assyrian invasion. Israelites are the people who claim Jacob as their spiritual patriarch. Jacob, remember, whose name means trickster, stole Esau's birthright from their blind father Isaac by putting a goatskin on his arms to make them feel more like his brothers. His name was then changed to Israel only after a long night of battling his own bad conscience for what he'd done. And he was battling this angel sent by God. Jacob means Israel not by hearing the word of God, but by wrestling with him. Since Jacob awakes from his dream alone but physically injured, it's been suggested that this long night of wrestling with God was actually a battle with himself. That's a little bit too much psychologizing for me, but I get it. The faith of Israel then, what we call Judaism, was born not out of acceptance of a belief, but out of a willingness to challenge one's beliefs. What is Judaism, after all, if not the willingness to ask questions? And though I'm not crazy necessarily about where this author ends up, in some places, I think he's on the right track, absolutely, in this idea that if the Jewish identity is found in wrestling, and another word for that wrestling is walking through the wilderness. This is what the people of God are being called to do, right? And we're going to spend the next few weeks, or likely the next few years, talking about that. So the Jews are perpetually, the Hebrews, the Israelites, are perpetually becoming. And this is important for us as Christians because we've inherited that essential movement as place, future in present, motion as essence, right? Because for Christians in particular, you know, Jesus says a number of different places in a number of different ways, no, I'm the tabernacle. The tabernacle for the Jews was where God was located. And Jesus is like, no, now I'm it. I'm the tabernacle, right? And everyone was like, well, who the hell do you think you are? God? Yes. I'm the tabernacle now. So we worship a God that is no longer bound to place, but moves. And we move with God. And isn't it surprising then, or maybe not surprising at all, that the central Christian identity is one of movement, pilgrimage, journey, Great Commission, moving, going, right? That's who we are. We were never meant to be static. So we've inherited this movement as place. We are who we are becoming. And to use a kind of hackneyed phrase, it's sort of fated to us that we are who we are becoming. And this is, again, not surprisingly, when I teach my course in theological anthropology with my students, it's the final class that some of our students take their senior year. So it's a lot of heavy reading. It's pretty intense. But the conclusion we reach with that is, and we bring in psychology, philosophy, theology, and literature, and we just kind of all sort of unpack it together. And what we realize all the way from Homer's Odyssey to Gulliver's Travels and everything in between, that, and we bring in as much science as we can, because even the sort of that quantum world is very much living out and becoming a parable for what the Greek mythos and the Judeo-Christian tradition has been saying for a long time, that a thing is what it is only in relationship to something else, that we are becoming, that we are who we are becoming. Okay, all right. So this is God's providence. It's Presbyterians like the word predestination. His calling us so that, called as we are by God, we are shaped by the direction of that call. That's what shapes you and me. We are shaped by the direction of that call. Some of us are keenly aware of our call and doesn't make life necessarily any simpler. We're still trying to... And some of us don't really quite know what our call is. And frankly, if we're honest, some of us couldn't give a darn about our call. We just want to pay the bills and make some money and be done with it and just, you know, whatever, which is unfortunate because you're giving up your birthright because God has a call for you. We are people who have been called. But in any case, this direction of the call is what defines our essence. We are people being formed. We're forms. We are forms in formation. And we need to try to understand this as we move forward in Exodus, because that is the entire dynamic of Exodus, is essence as motion, as movement. It describes a state of being, but it's also a place to be. I've said this before in this class, probably my favorite word, and it's probably one of your favorite words too in the English language, is home. I love home, the word home, and what I find so unique about home. And it's touched on in the opening lines of Patch Adams, that really lovely movie, is that home is both a place of origin and a place of destination. So it's the only word in the English language that means its opposite. It means both the place you start and the place you end. That's what makes baseball the quintessential iconic game of America. Because there are two things you want more than anything else. You want to leave home and you want to get home, right? This is T.S. Eliot's as a major sport, right? To end up where you started and see the place for the very first time, right? This is what makes baseball the quintessential American game, because we are all people who we're all immigrants, not to get too political about it, but we all are. We're all what makes the United States of America unique is we are a country fundamentally defined. Our essence is immigrant. We are all immigrants. We are an immigrant nation. Always have been, always will be. That's who we are. And we came looking for a new place, and then we're in California, which is, of course, we are like ground zero of immigrants because we're Californians. I don't know if any of you have lived on the East Coast, but East Coast people are weird, right? Because they don't move much. They just settle in. They build roots. They don't understand we people on the left coast who are just constantly left in more ways than one, but just constantly, you know, being all itinerant. And I'd like to say, well, it's our movement that defines us. And that doesn't preach in New Jersey. So it's a movement. We are perpetually in movement. We are perpetually in exodus. We are perpetually in that sort of movement, but it's not, again, random movement, but purposeful movement, a direction with a goal, entelechy. And more to the point, and this was central, I think, to both Aristotle and Aquinas, it's a movement from a part to a whole, from a lesser to a greater. It is an energy that counters death, which is a movement from death is the opposite, right? It's a movement from whole to part. You're dying. It's done. It's over. But the radical position of the Christian is that it's precisely in Christ's death that we move. His death broke that key. It disrupted the entropy that had been introduced by sin into the world. It disrupted it because Jesus, according to the universal law, shouldn't have died because the wages of sin are death, but he never sinned, and yet he died anyway. So he literally broke the code. Boom! It was a major cosmic disruption. And now if we follow Christ, to use really super kind of new agey language that will make my dad's toes curl, if we kind of buy in to the energy of who Jesus Christ is. Oh, I blush even as I say that, but you know what I mean. If it's Jesus' love and life and it's what we celebrate in communion today, we are organically and existentially and spiritually and physically entering into that space who is Jesus Christ. And so with the radical position of the Christian is that it's precisely death, the thing that's supposed to bring entropy, that ends up bringing life. But it's not anyone's death, it's Christ's death. So that death is no longer chaos or entropy or disintegration, but rather a portal or a change of state that ushers in integration and completion and restoration. Now, let's bracket all that for a minute. You can take your thinking caps off now because we're moving into things that are a little bit, I think, just whatever, easier to swallow. Let's bracket for a minute that and return to the importance of place and the role that it plays in our lives. And I've read over the course of these last couple of years, actually, from Belden Lane, his book, The Solace of Fierce Landscapes. And I love that book very much. I like it a lot. And I'm making my way very slowly through it. But in his book, The Solace of Fierce Landscapes, he makes the point, right, that the where of our lives, where we are, plays a much bigger role in our lives and in how we understand ourselves and each other and God than most of us think. That if you're in an urban setting like Hollywood, LA, it is necessarily going to affect, as it should, your role of yourself, others, God, how that all works out, because we are people that are fundamentally defined by place, as much as we are by movement. Which is why there is a long tradition in Christianity, a very long tradition, not only of sacred journeys, right, and of pilgrimage that people would make. You know, the Compostela, the road that people take through Spain, that whole thing, all those pilgrimages, that's a huge part of our history. But what is also a big part of our history is the interior landscape of the soul and the journey, the journeys that people take interior, not just exterior. So you can, if you're fortunate enough and you were able to cobble together enough money, you could make a pilgrimage even to Jerusalem. That was the ultimate goal for the Christians of old. But if you didn't have that, well, what was it like? Well, unlike our Muslim brothers and sisters for whom the ultimate goal is a Hajj to Mecca, we can meet our ultimate goal in an interior way, right? And what's interesting is that for the Christian, it's not the journey we take to God, but the journey we take with God. We don't have to take a pilgrimage or a journey to reach God. God is there with us and takes us on the journey. So we don't, it's not something that we moved towards him. So there's this long tradition of this interior landscape of the soul. And if you can't move geographically, the conventional wisdom goes, well, you can move spiritually or existentially from within. And our Christian tradition would argue, and I agree with it, that of the two, geographical and existential spiritual, obviously the second is the more important of the two. Not only of changing, but growing internally. Some of us call it spiritual growth, which is entirely possible in a prison cell. I mean, some of the best things ever written, some of the best transformations that ever happened in a prison cell. You can go back to the Apostle Paul, you can go to Martin Luther King, you can experience a tremendous amount of growth in a, 10 by 10 foot concrete room, right? You can do that for sure. Where geography is static. And the opposite is true. You can travel the world and see the great sights and be the most well-traveled person in the world and remain essentially unchanged. It doesn't do a thing to you. You can change jobs. You can change spouses, hobbies, nationalities. You can change anything and still remain essentially the same unchanged person. So what I think is interesting is the implication of this. What I'm basically trying to say, I think, and this holds as true for the Hebrews as it is for you and me, that the degree to which our lives don't reach their potential is the degree to which we aren't fully alive. Okay, now I've just said that, and I'm fully aware that I just sounded like a little, Aesop fable or fortune cookie. But let me try to explain. I just said that the degree to which our lives do not reach their potential is the degree to which we are not fully alive. Okay, fair enough. That could be something that they're saying right over there in Tom Cruise's church. But let me add a particularly Christian perspective on that. I say all of this with the crucial caveat, which is that we don't try to live up to our potential or purpose in life for the purpose of being saved. From the Christian perspective, there is no clear that we reach because we've stepped through these things and done this. And, it's the Robert Bly ride the white horse and through the dark valley and reach the prince. That book that was all the rage many years ago and that I read because I thought it would usher me into manhood. And it didn't manage to do that. But it's not that. That's not what I'm saying, that that's what we do, that we actualize our potential so that we can be saved. No, not at all. This is not true at all, as if somehow our works will earn us salvation, that if you just do these things, you'll be saved. No, we do none of these things in order to be saved. You don't live out your full potential or try to in order to be saved. We do these things because we've been saved. That is the crucial, absolutely significant difference. And it's the ongoing argument that my father and I have had for close to 50 years. And he doesn't get to say anything, so I get, it's my turn, Dad. but it's a friendly argument that we've had all along. But I think my dad and others have confused soteriology with ethics. Soteriology is the study of how we're saved. And I am not suggesting, and my dad is right to criticize anyone who does, that to reach your potential is to somehow save yourself. No. That's to take the entire thrust of the Bible and turn it on its head. We live to reach our potential because we've been saved already. We live our lives to their fullest potential because it is our way of giving thanks to God for having saved us. This is why we live a life committed to ethics, why we live a life where we try to live to our fullest potential, not so that we will be saved, but because we have been saved. And this is our way of giving back. This is our way of saying thank you. I love that in the Heidelberg Catechism, I think it's the Heidelberg Catechism, the Ten Commandments are listed in the section called gratitude. We'll talk about that in a few weeks, right? But you don't do the Ten Commandments so that you'll be saved, as I've said in this class many times. The Ten Commandments is our response to having been saved. It was the Jewish response to having already been saved. I am the Lord your God, Yahweh Elohim Adonai. I am the Lord your God who has already saved you, brought you out of Egypt, saved you. So here's your response. But what churches have done, and we've become remarkably effective at this, is we've turned it on its head. Here are all the things you need to do in order to be saved. That's just simply wrong. It's the exact opposite of the good news. Well, this very same dynamic holds true for the Jews. The journey through the wilderness, note, is after they've been rescued. It's not the journey through the wilderness to be rescued. Now, granted, it's the journey through the wilderness to get to the land of milk and honey. But isn't that true for all of us? This life is the wilderness. This is Dante, right? We're living the comedy. And we are making our way with God's help through the valley of the shadow of death, aka the wilderness, aka our lives. And that what's so fabulous is that what's meeting us, what's breaking in towards us is the kingdom of God. So it's a very dynamic movement. It's not like heaven sits there like some Valhalla that we're supposed to reach eventually if we're just strong enough and we're like, you know, decent enough pilgrims. No, there's a sandstorm coming our way and we're meeting it. And it's this really lovely sort of spiritual conflagration that's going on. And I think about this, the journey of the wilderness for the Jews, for the Israelites, was after they've been rescued. It isn't some sort of ancient Near Eastern obstacle course they have to make it through in order to be saved. And we have to keep this in mind as we make our way through Exodus, two-thirds of the book happens post-Exodus. And I thought again about us and us as Christians. Our lives as Christians is often spent devising ways we can love better. We can love God better. We can be better, you know, at this or better at that, presumably so that we might have a better chance of being saved. When all the while God has already saved us and our only appropriate response to God is gratitude. That's the life of the Christian. It's as Buechner said, that the only difference between a Christian and a non-Christian is a Christian knows who to thank. That's our point, is you live a life of gratitude, which I am suggesting can take the form of living transformed lives, of living our life to its fullest potential, to the people God has actually called us to be. That's what it means to live to your potential. This is this dynamic of actuality and potentiality, right? This whole Aristotelian thing is AKA gratitude. So you live this life, you commit yourself to a high ethical standard, you forgive your enemy, that's how you typically love him or her, that you love your neighbor, that you follow the commandments out of gratitude for what God has already done for us. It's not the way that we earn the cheese, it's what we do after we've been given the cheese. We've already been saved. This isn't the victorious life. This is the grateful life. There is a huge difference between what I'm saying and what Joel Osteen is saying. The victorious life wants to tell you that if you are faithful, God will grant you the power to be victorious over all things. I'm saying that Jesus is the victorious one. He's the one that achieves the victory over sin, death, and the devil. Not so that we might be victorious, but so that we might be grateful for his victory, that we might be faithful to him. And through him, we can conquer all things. But it is also through him that we are often called to be conquered, to serve others, to suffer, to die for those we have been called to. So the victorious life is a life focused on the individual. The grateful life is a life focused on God and other people. How can I live a life of gratitude and give God thanks by doing that? The victorious life is about winning. The grateful life is about being willing to lose for the sake of others. It is the willingness, as the Hebrews will soon find out, to wander through the wilderness in order to understand the severity of God's mercy. That's the part that's become so fascinating about Exodus, is you want to know how to give God thanks? Oh, well, let's see. Let's walk through the wilderness for 40 years because I tried to make it easy on you guys and you blew it. So, you know what? Because I love you, it's like that dynamic that we talked about in the Mission, right? The film The Mission, where Robert De Niro's character, Captain Mendoza, has to suffer through penance to truly be changed and redeemed. And Father Gabriel, Jeremy Irons' character, knows it. Don't cut off his burden too quickly. It'll be a premature sort of forgiveness. It'll feel cheap. It'll be, in Bonhoeffer's terms, cheap grace. No. Let him carry the burden. He needs to carry the burden. And then the one who is in the position to forgive him will do that. And that's what the Guadani chieftain does. And then Captain Mendoza, his life is utterly transformed. It's the same with us. And it's the same with the Israelites, is that God was like, okay, I get it. You're more hard-headed than I thought. So this ought to clear the nasal passages. Wander for 40 years, a generation. I sometimes wonder if we aren't in our own exilic wilderness because of what my generation did for the younger generation. Maybe we're in such a lost state as a nation because we are in this exile. On the other hand, maybe we're always perpetually in exile. In a small and almost ridiculous parallel, when I was working out yesterday, it was literally the last thing I wanted to do. I did not want to work out. And I don't know if any of you can relate to that, but I am not like those people who are like, yippee, I get to work out. It was just like, oh, I just want to sit on the couch and eat bonbons and watch TV. But I knew I'd be doing that a lot later today. So, but then I thought about this as I was going over this class, and I actually changed my mindset. And again, this is going to sound so corny, but I hope you can relate to this. That suddenly this workout that I was going to do wasn't so much anything I had to do as something that I got to do. It's a small change, a little difference, but it was no longer, oh, I have to do this. I was like, I get to do this. I have a healthy enough body that I can work out. Thank the good Lord, I can do it. And I'm feeling pretty good, even though I'm tired, but I can do it. I made my working out not a burden, but a privilege. And that's a gift, and I'm grateful for it. And so I went into the workout session thinking, I'm grateful. This is my way of expressing my gratitude to God for helping me make good choices about what it means to be healthy. And then it occurred to me again that all opportunities, all of our talents and skills are both burden and privilege. They are both simultaneously, and we have to decide how we choose to view them. So your wealth, for those of you who are wealthy, it's both a burden and a privilege, right? Because it's a privilege to be wealthy, but it's a burden to have that wealth. And so we have to decide, for those of us who find ourselves in a place like that, what are we going to do with those things? For those of us who are talented at a particular thing, and all of us in this room are talented at least at one thing, it's our talent, our skills, the gifts we've been given, they are both burden for sure, but they are also privilege. And so do we look at it as a burden or do we look at it as a privilege? You know, my wife and I are always talking about first world problems, right? And a first world problem is, oh, I'd love to get the Mercedes, but I can only afford the Volvo. Right? That's a first world problem. Like, oh, I'd love to buy some land up in wine country, but it's so expensive. Wah, 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 wah. die, you know, you poor thing, right? And I'm talking really just to one couple in the room. but no, I mean, we're in it together. They understand. But, you know, we have first world problems. And so we have to change our perspective. And I know this runs dangerously close to sounding like an Ann Landers advice column. But I mean it in its most obvious and profound sense, that the Christian faith is either one of a long series of have-tos or it's one in a long series of get-tos. I get to do this. I get to come to church. I don't have to come to church. I get to come to church. Oh, today I get to work at the Lord's Lighthouse. I don't have to work at the Lord's Lighthouse. I get to do it. Oh, that's so terrific. That's wonderful. Either I worship God and follow Christ because it's my fate in life, the burden I have to carry, or the burden I'm called to carry is the way I show my gratitude for God's having already saved me, love. Oh, yeah, it's a burden. We pick up our crosses, no doubt about that. But you don't pick up your cross in order to be saved. You pick up your cross because you've been saved. And if you're anything like me, that tiny little nuance makes all the difference in the world. It makes all the difference in how we, because it seems to me, not just theologically, but spiritually, it makes a difference. And when I say spiritually, I actually mean practically. We are called, indeed invited, to live our lives to their fullest potential, not out of some impulse for victorious living, which is a kind of spiritual narcissism, but out of a desire to express to God our deepest gratitude. Lord, I want to be a Christian in my heart. Lord, I want to be more faithful. Lord, I want to use the talents you've given me in more thoughtful ways. And none of those things are so that you might save me, but because you have saved me. And how would this look in other ways, in practical ways, again, by which I mean spiritual? Well, depending on who you are, I wrote some ideas down. It might mean for you being more disciplined with your time and how you spend it. In fact, I'm willing to bet that's true of all of us in this room, right? With the invention of the portable slot machine, otherwise known as your iPhone, we now all have a problem with time management. And the person who is truly disciplined is the remarkable person. I'm getting better at it, but I'm far from good at it. So for you, this living a life of gratitude might mean, how are you with your social media? How are you with the amount of time you spend looking at a screen? Because maybe your way of showing gratitude is by ditching the screen. Ditch the screen. It may mean being deliberate about reaching out to those you feel have wronged you and seeking reconciliation. I bet there are quite a few people in this room, if you're a normal human being, who has a broken relationship that needs mending. Maybe the irritating responsibility of the Christian is to be the first one to step out and try to mend. And some of you maybe have done that. But maybe that's what it means to live to your fullest potential, is forgive the people that have wronged you, that you have nursed that grudge for decades. Maybe the time is now to reach out, to send that email, to send a letter, to make a phone call. Who knows? It might mean taking up again a spiritual discipline that you've let slip by the wayside. Maybe it's once again recommitting. I mean, it is February now. All the January commitments have failed utterly. So now we can recommit and say, Lord, I want to help. Give me the strength to be more disciplined in my Bible study. To exercise maybe the spiritual discipline of fasting, whatever. It might mean trusting God with a big life-changing decision and making steps to actualize that change. Something scary. Maybe you feel called to something new, a different place to live, a different job to have, but you've been kind of scared to do it because not all the T's are crossed and not all the I's are dotted. But maybe you need to do it. And maybe this is your way of showing gratitude to God. It might mean forgiving someone. We've already done that. It might mean doing a workout and changing your diet or sleeping habits in order to be a healthier version of yourself. It can look like a lot of things. But whatever it looks like, its purpose is to express thanks to God for having saved you and me, for his salvation, for the gift of his son, Jesus Christ. And this is the hard lesson that it took the Hebrews 40 years to learn, an entire generation. And when I look back on my life, I figure it's taken about as long, about 40 years. And I'm still learning it, what a life of gratitude actually looks like. What does it look like to be full of gratitude? Okay, so geography matters. For the Jews, who were a people singled out by God, but who were also becoming who they had been called to be, Exodus is a story of a people called, but not yet fully actualized. They're still a people looking for a place. They're through the wilderness. Geography made all the difference in the world for the Jews, as I am suggesting it even makes for us. They could never finally be their full potential as one singled out by God while they were still enslaved in Egypt. They just couldn't do it. It just wasn't the right place. It wasn't the right geography for them to fully live out their calling. Their destiny lay further on to a place as yet unknown. And this is basically what the book of Exodus is all about. It's a story of a people now having lived through a few generations of patriarchs who are now becoming themselves, becoming who they were called to be. And this is how they responded to that dynamic. The introduction in the Good News Bible lays out Exodus in four parts. And for those of you following along in Scripture, here's kind of the four parts. The freeing of the Hebrews from slavery, the first 15 chapters. Then their journey to Mount Sinai, it's three chapters there. Then God's covenant with his people at Sinai, which gives them moral and civil and religious laws to live by. And that's another five chapters. And then finally, the last 15 chapters or so is the building and furnishing of a place of worship for Israel and the laws regarding the priests and the worship of God. So now listen to the first chapter of the book of Exodus in the idiom of the Good News translation. Here it goes. The sons of Jacob who went to Egypt with him, each with his family, were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number of these people directly descended from Jacob was 70. So you have the brothers, the sons of Jacob, which included Joseph, and their children and whatever. His son Joseph was already in Egypt, as we know. In the course of time, Joseph, his brothers, and all the rest of that generation died. But their descendants, the Israelites, had many children and became so numerous and strong that Egypt was filled with them. Then a new king who knew nothing about Joseph came to power in Egypt. He said to his people, "These Israelites are so numerous and strong that they are a threat to us. In case of war, they might join our enemies in order to fight against us and might escape from the country. We must find some way to keep them from becoming even more numerous." So the Egyptians put a travel ban. So the Egyptians put slave drivers over them to crush their spirits with hard labor. The Israelites built the cities of Pithom and Ramses to serve as supply centers for the king. But the more the Egyptians oppressed the Israelites, the more the Israelites increased in number and the further they spread through the land. The Egyptians came to fear the Israelites and made their lives miserable by forcing them into cruel slavery. They made them work on their building projects and in their fields, and they had no mercy on them. Do I have the 22 Israelites? I don't, do I? Okay, good. I took that out. So they made them work on their building projects and in their fields, and they had no mercy on them. Then the king of Egypt spoke to Shifra and Puah, the two midwives who helped the Hebrew women. "When you help the Hebrew women give birth," he said to them, "kill the baby if it is a boy, but if it is a girl, let it live." But the midwives feared God and so did not obey the king. Instead, they let the boys live. So the king sent for the midwives and asked them, "Why are you doing this? Why are you letting the boys live?" And they answered, "The Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They give birth easily and their babies are born before either of us gets there." I'm noticing half the room giggling at that. Because the midwives feared God, he was good to them and gave them families of their own. And the Israelites continued to increase and become strong. Finally, the king issued a command to all his people, take every newborn Hebrew boy and throw him into the Nile, but let all the girls live. And you'll see, right, already a parallel to what happens right after Jesus is born. What we have here in this first chapter of Exodus reads like a sociopolitical tract or a textbook of some kind. And Dennis Olson, my Old Testament professor at Princeton Seminary, wrote this about the beginning of Exodus. By the end of the Genesis narrative, the Israelites had achieved most favored immigrant status in the land of Egypt. But then came the great disruption. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Exodus 1:8. Israel's status quickly deteriorated from welcomed guests, Genesis 45, to feared aliens and oppressed slaves. The text reveals again the interaction of politics, ethnic difference, and religion as a volatile cauldron for human interaction with potential both for great good and great evil. Attempting political strategy for new leaders, whether an Egyptian pharaoh or a Nazi Hitler, involves trying to solidify power by singling out a relatively weak minority or outsider group and calling them an enemy. Fear of others can be a powerful source of unity. In Exodus 1, Pharaoh singles out the rapidly expanding Hebrew minority as an emerging threat. What Genesis describes as God's faithfulness in blessing the Israelites through many descendants, there's various verses, Pharaoh describes as a terroristic threat that may endanger Egypt's security and way of life. There is no hint in the biblical narrative that the Israelites are anything but good, faithful citizens of the empire, yet the delusional Pharaoh imagines that the growing but still small Israelite minority in Egypt is more numerous and more powerful than we. He warns the Egyptians that in the event of war, the Israelites might join our enemies and fight against us. I mean, honestly, I'm having a difficult time not snickering because of the similarities to our present-day sociopolitical reality. Olson continues. Pharaoh begins with a preemptive strike upon the Israelites and the illusory threat they might pose. He forces the Israelites into slave labor to build two of Pharaoh's supply cities, which serve the oppressive Egyptian economy in the disruption of goods rigidly controlled from the top. Sounds like their version of Amazon. Yet paradoxically, the more the Israelites are oppressed, the more they multiply and spread. The goal of Pharaoh's strategy had been to diminish and weaken the Israelites, but the biblical text testifies, and this is what I underlined, that there is another power at work in, with, and through the Israelite people. God's blessing and sustaining activity, although hidden at this point in the narrative, remains at work among the Israelites in their suffering. God will have the final word here. Pharaoh may think that he is in control, but as the story of Exodus unfolds, the reader will be constantly reminded that God alone is ultimately judge, Lord, and Savior. Now, regardless of where any of us is in the political current political spectrum, it's incumbent upon us as Christians to understand that with all that the tumult that's happening politically in our country, that there is another power at work beneath, behind the political systems and economic machines that we read about 24/7 that increasingly exercise control over our lives. My mom just gave me an article from the New York Times last week about this program that the government is doing to see just how closely they can monitor the movement of average citizens. It's been a program that's been lasted a few years now, and through very clever journalism on the part of some New York beat journalists, they found out what the city was that had been chosen a few years ago. Did y'all read this? Pasadena. We are the most watched city in all North America. Isn't that lovely? They know exactly where we go, where we're going, how much we spend. Now, they say that they don't have our identity, but they have tracked us, and they have used the software to track us. So, Jen and I will be moving soon out of Pasadena. Even if we don't see God's hand in obvious ways, the Bible directs us to trust that God is at work in ways we don't fully understand. Such a thing can, of course, be a call to willful ignorance or a subtle enticement to see God's hand even where it doesn't exist. But that's not what Dennis Olson is saying. It's certainly not what I'm saying. Olson is explaining how God's hand, his providence, if you want to call it that, is always at work for the benefit of the pushed down and the powerless, the downtrodden, for those who are treated unjustly. That's where God's hand is at work, in the people who have been pushed unfairly down by socioeconomic realities. God sides with those people, with those who have been treated unjustly. God, as it turns out, does take sides. And it's not with any particular political party or social agenda, but with those who are suffering abuse at the hands of the more powerful and privileged. When we see huge amounts of power at work in the world, there's a good chance that God is not blessing such things. Now, I don't want to take that to its ultimate extreme. I don't mean to suggest that God is never on the side of the victor. Quite on the contrary. I think, for example, the argument has been made, and I have no reason to discredit it in any way, that the Allied forces in World War II were an instrument of God's will in stopping the Axis powers. Now, it's a little dicey for me because it involves war, but a much clearer example is the obvious will of God that the 49ers will win this afternoon. That's obvious. That's quite clear to all of us. And I just want you to know that if you doubt God's existence, just watch the Super Bowl and you will see the 49ers crush the Kansas City Chiefs. What's also interesting about the opening chapter in Exodus is that the Hebrews people are interchangeably referred to as the Hebrews and the Israelites. But how could they be Israelites? Israel wasn't even a thing. I mean, Israel was a person in Jacob, but there was no Israel. Unless this is shorthand for the descendants of Joseph, but then why are they called Hebrews in other parts? What you see here, just from a literary standpoint, is two traditions coming together. And these traditions were written at slightly different times. It turns out the book of Exodus was compiled and written down, biblical scholars tell us, right around the time the Israelites were under occupation in Babylon in 600 BC. That's when all these stories were compiled and written down, almost half a millennium after these events actually took place. They were in exile reading and writing about their history in exile. And, as it turns out, about a people who were eventually rescued. Wouldn't that be encouraging? If you were in Babylonian, the Babylonians were suppressing you, were oppressing you, you were effectively in exile, and your history said, this isn't anything new. You've been in exile before, and God's mighty hand was stretched out to rescue you. Oh, that would give you, it'd be so encouraging. So even if this did actually happen exactly as it stated in Exodus, it would be irresponsible not to notice that this story would have been incredibly encouraging for the Israelites, right? Remember how I began, and this is where I'll end, with the Aristotelian idea of motion and movement, that house defines a thing in its essence. It defines a thing in its essence. Well, this is exactly the story of God's chosen people. This is why we started the way we did. They are a people constantly on the move, a people constantly being threatened by some kind of usurpation, a people with multiple diasporas in their history, where they are spread far and wide by geopolitical forces, a people who are defined by their movement to and from a place, a people, in other words, defined by potentiality and actuality, a people called to a land who have just as often been thrust from that land. And for those of us, the new Israel, Judeo-Christian tradition, that place, that land is the kingdom of God. It's not Israel. It's not America. It's the kingdom of God that we are called to usher in. It's the place we are called to, but we are still somewhat separated from. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. That's why you can be every bit as close to God at the Lord's Lighthouse as you can be at Forest Home. We are right in here together. We too, as Christians, find ourselves in a bit of a movement as essence predicament. This is the Christian life. This is this interesting dynamic of now but not yet. Right? It's this, we are a people called by God. The kingdom of God is breaking in, but it hasn't yet been consummated. This is the dynamic of the Christian, of the person individually and of the Christian corporately. This is the church right now. We are in a period technically of exile. And we are who we are becoming. So the Christian life is a pilgrimage, it's a journey, it's a dual citizenship that marks the essence of what it means to be a Christian, one who is in exile while simultaneously a part of the kingdom of God. We are potentiality and actuality, a movement through the wilderness from slavery to freedom. That is, our movement defines who we are. This is our journey. And the next few weeks or months, we will look at this journey for what it looked like for our ancestors who pretty much wrote the book, pun intended, on what it means to be an exiled and Exodus people. So we have a few minutes for comments or questions or anything like that.